Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with Professor Tamara Phillips. She's a professor of behavioral neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University, and she's going to be talking to us about the genetics of addiction. But before we get onto that, welcome to the program, Tamara.
Oh, thank you very much.
Before we get into addiction, genetics, behavior, let's talk a little bit about Tamara. How did you become a scientist? What were those driving moments?
I was actually initially a music major.
Ah, wonderful.
And there's a strong correlation between mathematics ability and music ability. And after about a year of being a music major in college, I realized that to make a living, I would not really be able to perform so much. I'd have to teach, and that wasn't really what I wanted to do with my music. So by then, I'd taken some science courses and had fallen in love.
Where was this?
This was at Arizona State University.
Okay.
And so I decided to switch majors and became what we call an experimental psychology major. And eventually, I moved from Arizona to New Jersey. And I was getting high grades on my chemistry exams and got noticed by some of the professors.
Good woman.
And was asked to work in one of their research labs. And so that was my introduction to research and to getting
into it. So as a school child, though, it was music and all these other things
yes,
were secondary.
Yes. All the other things were secondary. Music really was the thing I loved the most. But I was a very good student as well.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. What did you play?
I played the flute.
The flute?
Yes.
Do you still maintain that interest?
I do occasionally play, and my daughter now plays the flute, so I've passed that along to her.
And I agree with you. I've had many postdocs, and one of the questions that I ask, do you play a musical instrument?
Mm-hmm.
And if they say yes, then I automatically almost just say, okay, I've got space.
Yeah.
I think there's the discipline that you get from learning to play well a musical instrument. It stands you in good stead, no matter what the rest of your career is.
Yeah, I think that's true. My son was a great trombone player, too, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so then you went off to graduate school. Where did you go to graduate school?
I went to the State University of New York in Albany, New York.
Right.
I finished my graduate degree there in about 4.5 years, and then I went on to do a postdoc at Rutgers University, and then a second postdoc in Portland, Oregon, and eventually became a professor
there. I mean, and thereby hangs a sort of a story for people who think, well, I want a career in science, especially in the behavioral, biologically inclined. A lot of postdoctoral experience seems to be needed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking personally, I think there's something wrong with the system that you go away, you get your degrees, you do well, you get a PhD, maybe a year postdoc just to get a different area and maybe even to take a deep breath, right, somewhere different, but then carry on with your career. But it's very difficult to do that these days.
It's gotten worse, I believe. I did a total of 3 postdoctoral years, and now people are doing 6 years,
yeah.
You know, and it's taking them until they're over 40 years old to get their first real grant.
That's what I was reading. The National Institutes of Health say,
yes.
I think the average age for people getting their first R01, which is the big mainline grant, is in excess of 40 years old.
Yes, indeed.
I wouldn't have gone there.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got to 33, I'd said, to hell with this. I mean, it's just not conducive to maintaining enthusiasm along the way.
I think it's very depressing for the students to see how things have gone and how the funding for science has gone down, or at least not increased to keep up with the costs of things. So I think it is difficult for graduate students these days to maintain their interest and get through.
In the medical school where you are in Oregon, this is in Portland, do you give PhDs and MD PhDs?
Yes, we do.
Before we get on to what you do, I'm interested because a lot of our students, the bright ones, think, MD PhD, because they know, first of all, they will get free tuition. They haven't got to pay anything,
absolutely.
And they'll get paid, right? And it's almost certain that they're going to land up with some nice job as long as they go through and finish, you know, in a medical school, teaching and doing research and being a doctor. But what's the difference between these two programs from your point of view?
Between PhD and MD PhD.
Yes, right.
Well, MD PhD will take you a little longer to complete. You do a couple of years of medical school, and then you go do your PhD, which takes a good 4 to 5 years to complete. So there you are at 7 years or so before you go back and finish some of your medical school for another year or two. So it's quite a bit longer period of time to finish that. But the advantage is you can fall back on your clinical career if your research career isn't going so well.
Well, I mean, and that's part of my critique, in a sense, that I've known quite a few of the students that have gone through here who have gone away, got MD, PhDs, and then when you look back 10, 15 years later, really they're MDs.
They're using their MD only.
Right, yeah. And the research has sort of fallen by the way.
Right. So with the PhD, I think that's very common. With the PhD, to survive, you have to keep up with the science and you have to use that degree and write grants and stay in it. With the MD, PhD, there's not as much pressure to do that, right? And I think that because it is difficult writing grants and getting funding and easier to fall back on your medical career, that's what happens a lot. So PhD takes 5 to 6 years to complete.
Yeah, so, but then you've got the extra 6 years of postdoc.
But then you've got all the postdoc, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so the classic MD, PhD doesn't do much in the way of postdoctoral.
Well, if they want their own research lab, it just depends upon exactly how they're going to construct their career after doing that. But you're right, they don't necessarily do a postdoc because they can get a clinical job and then find a way to start up a lab on the side with their clinical job.
Right.
And it can be hard for them, though, to find the time to do the research. And they rarely can do it as extensively as someone who's just got the PhD.
I have a hard time advising students. And I tend to think that the people who want to go for the MD, PhD are the people that are saying this to fulfill some requirement of how they've been funded as an undergraduate or the promises they've made.
Mm-hmm.
So, MD, PhD. And then it becomes more and more MD.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
Let's get back to Tamara. So subsequent to your postdoctoral experiences, how did you decide in Oregon what you wanted to study?
Fortunately, the work that I was doing in Oregon was well aligned with what I had been trained to do as a graduate student. So I was already in the addiction research field. And genetics is my love, though. I think genetics is very interesting in the way that it controls some of our behaviors or the way it influences risk for some things that we do, and I always wanted to do that. So when I got to Portland, I started working with someone who was also a behavioral geneticist, very well aligned with what I do. And it was an immediate, instant, excellent collaboration. And fortunately, he was also a superb mentor, and we were able to part out things that we could each do and work alongside each other without competing with each other. And I was able to become independent of him in that way. So I was most interested really in risk for addiction, genetic risk, what made some people more prone to become addicted than others, what were the protective factors for people who didn't become addicted even though they tried the same drugs that others did. And that was the part that I carved out for my career and what I've been doing ever since.
Just to jump to the end and then we'll come back and fill in the picture. Are we now at a position when, you can take a little bit of my tissue and say, here's a man who's going to be very prone to Guinness. Okay, also, not Guinness, but I mean mm-hmm. that I will be a risk taker mm-hmm. in the sense of alcohol, for example, or some other. Are we close to that?
We're certainly not there, but we are definitely on our way to getting there and identifying some genes that are important. And the whole idea here is to find those risk factors, exactly what can we measure. And maybe it doesn't need to be a DNA element. Maybe it's another behavioral type of measure. For example, brainwaves. There are some brainwaves that are different in people who have family histories of alcoholism. And in those
kids.
You mean
when presented with a beer?
No, not even that.
Will do a, no.
No, it doesn't even have to be in the presence of alcohol. If you just measure the children who have parents or grandparents who were alcoholic, if you measure their brainwave patterns just sitting resting, you can detect a certain brainwave that is present in them that isn't present in children who do not have parents or grandparents who are alcoholics.
Does that automatically mean they will develop into that
Absolutely
issue?
Not. And I always try to make that point,
right,
that these are risk factors that make them more at risk but do not guarantee, do not determine, this isn't determinism, that they will become alcoholics. It just puts them at greater risk.
So, I mean, that's one of the big arguments these days with people paying $500 for a genome test
right.
on their body, and they come back and, the analysis is, oh, my goodness, watch out for this disease, that disease, this, mm-hmm. this. And they're not really predictions. They
mm-hmm.
are probabilities.
They are probabilities.
In general, the public
yeah.
doesn't get probability,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, those tests are excellent if you really want to know that you're going to develop Huntington's disease, something that you can't do anything about.
Right.
But who really, you know, some people, why would you want to know about something that you can't do anything about, for one thing? So you have to be very careful about whether you...
So what you're saying is a disease like that, it's unambiguous that you
can
make a
prediction. Yeah, there
are
some unambiguous diseases that are like that. Alcoholism, addiction,
these
behaviors are not unambiguous diseases.
Right.
Yeah.
I think if I... Not that I'm going to have Huntington's disease, but if I knew I was going to have it, I think it would change. I'd enjoy life more.
Yeah, so you'd have to make that personal decision,
yeah,
right?
Precisely.
I want to know that answer.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you don't work with people very much.
We have a center, a methamphetamine abuse research center, and we have clinical researchers in the center, and I interact with them a lot, and we share data and make decisions about what should I study because of what you're getting and what might you study based on what I'm getting in my research.
So it's a very collaborative,
yes,
complementary activity.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's quite nice because you learn about real people, if you like, and then go back to your mice model, is it?
My mouse model, and NIH calls this translational research, trying to translate.
Okay. Yeah. Give us a breakthrough. Of all the bits and pieces that you've done, you know, you're an established person in this field,
mm-hmm,
and so you look back like we all do and say, oh, there's all these papers, but a few stick out. Tell us something that really sticks out in your memory of, mm-hmm, that this was really exciting when I was in it, and the result is really important, and I like this.
I can think of two. One is an older example where I started looking at a particular receptor in the brain called the GABA-B receptor, and asking the question of whether that had anything to do with the way the brain adapts to alcohol. You know, if you drink a lot, you develop tolerance, or you might develop something called sensitization from bathing your brain in alcohol. And the question is...
I have a drink from time to time. I've never thought of us going, say, let's go out tonight and bathe our brains in something.
That's right. But the people who drink a lot, you know, that's a problem. And your brain really adapts to that. And then what happens is you don't feel normal anymore unless you're drinking alcohol. We call those neuroadaptations. And the question is, what are those? And can we do something about them to bring you back to normal and affect your alcohol drinking? So I started testing this one mechanism and found that it very clearly did impact those adaptations and would also reduce the amount that animals would drink. And those studies have led to clinical trials that are now ongoing, and that has become a very interesting area and potentially a new pharmaceutical that will be used in humans if it develops well enough and proves to not be something that produces so many side effects that it can't be used.
Well, I have to ask this because our co-host isn't here today, but, I mean, have you patented this? Is this going to be something which, in fact, if it comes to fruition, you and your university will benefit from?
Not personally, because this was years ago when things just weren't being patented and we were doing all this research without anything like that going on. So, no, I won't benefit from this, but people will benefit from this.
Good. Tell us about the mouse model compared to any other model. I mean, are all mammals equally capable of becoming addicted?
Well, that's a good question. We haven't studied enough different species, I think, to know for sure if all of the mechanisms are identical. But certainly the rodent model, mouse or rat, shows a lot of the same characteristics of addiction that are seen in humans. The things that we can't model are social structure, you know, peer pressure, things like that with addiction. But we do see the exact same mechanisms in the mouse that have been shown through, for example, imaging studies in humans that are lit up by alcohol administration or other drug administration. And so in that way, they're a good model. Also, there's with regard to genetics, about 80% of the same genes are found in the mouse and the human. That's pretty good.
It's always seemed to me remarkable tell us, and then you go to other mammals where it's 90% and 99%, and then you and I probably... What is it, 0.01% different?
Yeah. So if I find something genetic in the mouse, I have a pretty good likelihood of being able to study that in the human because of that 80% number. Why the mouse? Well, mainly because the genetics have been carefully mapped in the mouse over many decades. Just because of someone named Abby Lathrop, who had a farm somewhere and started to notice differences among mice this was in Massachusetts, and started breeding some of these characteristics in the mice and inbreeding them so that they would be maintained.
Just a regular farmer,
who decided, you know, this was interesting. And whereas some breeding them for mouse fanciers, too, people who liked certain characteristics.
I never heard of the term mouse fancier. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Tamara Phillips, professor of behavioral neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Have you ever wondered how and why we age? That's among the key questions on aging. Another is whether all our cells age at the same rate along chronological time.
These questions have puzzled scientists for years. Could knowing the aging clock allow us to slow or roll back biological time? We're closer to an answer. Researchers can track our cells' biological age by comparing DNA methylation between healthy and cancerous tissue.
The process of DNA methylation is how our cells control which genes are active at any given time. This gave researchers a comprehensive look at the changes in cells, which allowed them to track time.
After examining 8,000 samples from 50 different human tissues around the body, they found while most tissues' biological age matched their chronological age, some did not.
A woman's breast tissue is 2 or 3 years older than her other tissues. In a woman with breast cancer, the adjacent healthy tissue is up to 12 years older than other body tissues, and the cancer cells themselves are 36 years older.
This could explain why breast cancer is prevalent and why we all face greater cancer risk with age. Plus, our biological clock isn't constant, going much faster from birth through adolescence, then slowing to a more constant rate in our 20s.
As for our stem cells, they're the age of newborns. That means if adult cells are reprogrammed into pluripotent stem cells, which we can do in the lab, these cells' biological clock gets reset to zero.
Could we actually tap into a real fountain of youth? We are, of course, getting way ahead of ourselves. But with these discoveries, it is not far-fetched to contemplate slowing or reversing the aging process.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Tamara Phillips, Professor of Behavioral Neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University. We're talking about patterns of behavior, the genetics of addition, and we're talking about the mouse model, and we just come across this expression called mouse fancier. Let's just dwell on that for a moment because it intrigues me. What do mouse fanciers do with their mice?
They just like to have them around, like someone who likes beautiful birds, right? So you've got a mouse that has a golden coat color, and they wanted more of those just as a pet. Or at one point, what was noticed is there were some mice that sort of were exhibiting this twirling behavior, and they thought, oh, isn't that
cute? You
mean
going around in circles?
Going around in circles.
Chasing the tail.
Well, not chasing their tail, just sort of going around in circles in one direction. And so they wanted more of those. And so when those were bred, it turns out that they had a dysfunction in their cerebellum of the brain. And those have actually become models for certain neurological diseases that exist in humans, like myelin deficiency diseases, like muscular dystrophy,
right,
where the sheath around your neurons in your brain degrades and you are incapable of controlling your muscles after a while. So there are certain of these mouse models, these fanciers wanted, that actually turned out to be good for studying certain diseases in humans.
So all the mice that you use are of the same genetic group? Or do you switch from one genetic group to another?
We switch around partly because we don't want to find something that is exclusive. We want to find things that are more broadly based because people are more genetically variable too. So we're careful not to just use one type.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because it's so much common sense, but it's not the common sense that someone who's not in the field would understand.
Mm-hmm.
There's something called a Sprague
Dolly Rat.
Right now, mm-hmm. But everybody uses them, so they must be genetically pretty
Sprague Dolly Rat is actually not an inbred strain. Let me explain what an inbred strain is real quickly. An inbred strain is where every single individual in that strain is genetically identical. It's like having a panel of
so clones.
Clones.
Yes.
Exactly. Sprague Dolly is what we call a heterogeneous stock. So each individual rat is different from every other. But still, it's a closed breeding population, so there are only certain number of genes represented in the Sprague Dolly, and there are many more in the rat kingdom that would not be represented there. So yes, people do use Sprague Dollies a lot, and those of us who are mouse geneticists complain about that. And say, why are you using those Sprague Dollies? Why have you ever tried this in another strain? How do you know it's not specific to Sprague Dollies? So that's a good criticism. Yeah.
Oh, that is interesting. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, just as I say, you see it all over the place.
Right.
Right? And there must be some company breeding these things.
Yes, they're
making a hell of a lot of money.
Yes, that's very true.
Whereas you get your mice. So your mice are not interbreeding with one another. So, I mean, it's not that random of a genetic pool that you're doing your experiments.
It's not random. We know what our mice are because we need to know what their genetic constitution is.
Right.
So we also purchase our mice from somebody who's making a lot of money called the Jackson Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
But they maintain large numbers of different inbred strains as well as heterogeneous stocks. We've also intercrossed.
And you just order what you want.
We order what we want.
It's like going to Costco.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And in some cases, we breed our own. We will selectively breed for something. In other words, I want mice that really like to drink methamphetamine. I can breed for that.
Tell me about alcohol a little bit. I've just been reading a book right now about the beginning of poisoning in New York cities in 1800s and early 1900s, where wood methanol, well, wood alcohol, methanol was, and I didn't know much about this, but methanol is terrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol is fine up to a point. Is that the same with your mice? Is methanol a particularly bad material regardless? And why is that? What's the big deal?
Well, methanol is a different molecular structure than ethanol, and it is more poisonous to the cells than ethanol is, and that's the whole story there. So methanol is a much stronger toxin or poison than
ethanol. But, I mean, is this
ethanol.
the metabolites that come, or is it a direct impact of the alcohol? I mean, the problem with, as I understand it anyway, when you get a headache after too much drinking, it's because you've got aldehydes.
Acid aldehydes.
Mm-hmm. It's bad for heads,
mm-hmm.
right? So is it just formaldehyde, I guess it would be, for methanol, and
yeah,
that's much worse?
It is the metabolites. And with acid aldehyde, the body has specific enzymes that are very good at clearing that away. With formaldehyde, that's not the case. So that's part of why you can drink a lot of alcohol and you don't build up as much acid aldehyde because your body's efficient. Now, the reason why certain Asian populations are protected against becoming alcoholics is because a lot of them have an enzyme that is not efficient at clearing acid aldehyde. And therefore, when they drink, that builds up in their bloodstream. It makes them feel very sick. In fact, antabuse, one of the treatments for alcoholism, works that way. It causes you not to be able to metabolize acetaldehyde, and therefore if you drink, you feel sick.
And you flush. Right, I remember.
Strong flushing reaction.
With some of my research group, and we were complaining once that the pina coladas didn't seem to have any rum in them. But we had a Chinese student, and she couldn't drink very much. One drink, and she'd go red.
Right,
but
yeah.
we used her as the proof. Because she didn't, after the pina coladas, she didn't turn red.
No flushing. So.
So there was no rum.
That's a good test.
So that was one of the stories that you said that was a success. And you alluded to the fact that there was another example from your repertoire.
So my most recent, I think, very exciting success is that I have a behavioral trait that I have been studying where 50% of the genetic variance is controlled by a single genetic region. That's very unusual. If we're lucky,
within the genome, there's one short sequence
on chromosome 10 in the mouse
okay.
that has an extreme effect on this particular behavior, and it happens to be methamphetamine self-administration. So,
you mean
to
drinking?
Me, yeah. yes, drinking yeah, in my case.
Drinking.
Yes, we're doing
right.
drinking. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I have bred lines of mice that either really like the meth or really avoid it, hate it. And this chromosome region on mouse 10 shows a very large impact on that trait. So what I'm doing now is trying to figure out exactly what that gene is. Now, because it controls so much of the genetic variance, I have a very good chance of identifying this gene. This has been very difficult in my field because if we're lucky, we find genes that control 10%, and then it's very difficult to figure out what the gene is. It's easy to find a genetic region, but you might have 100 genes in that region, so not so easy to find the gene. So I'm very excited because we already have some good evidence for certain genes that are important. One of them happens to be the mu opioid receptor gene, so the receptor that is impacted by morphine or heroin also seems to potentially be involved in methamphetamine use.
Let's assume that you're successful and you can hold it right down to the specifics. Mm-hmm. Then what?
Then you have the potential for developing therapies, pharmacological therapies, that interact with that system and potentially are better treatments than what we have now, which is pretty much nothing for especially psychostimulant abuse. NIDA has invested the National Institute of Drug Abuse has invested a huge amount of money in trying to identify pharmacological treatments for drug abuse, and there is not a single one for psychostimulants right now.
Certain populations, certain societies are more prone to this artificial stimulation, if I can put it that way. Methamphetamines, alcohol, not so much alcohol, it's pretty all around the world. Sometimes you think, well, this is just the nature of the human species, right? They're looking for something different, mm-hmm. all right? And okay, if it's not methamphetamines today, it'll be something else tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's rather like fighting bacteria, right? Mm-hmm. You get a new material, a new drug, and it does wonders, and then the bacteria change, and then you start all over again. This is, in fact, really chasing a tail.
Mm-hmm.
Is something built into the nature of the genetic makeup of people that we seek new and novel
yes.
ways to get out of the norm?
Because the things that you didn't put in that list are things like gambling, skydiving, seeking things that are thrilling,
right. yes.
because they activate your reward pathway in your
right.
brain.
So why bother to study this? This is a very naive question,
people,
and I don't believe it, but
yeah.
explain why.
Because people who have developed these addictions and are that have affected their family life, that affect society, that affect their ability to work, a lot of them do seek treatment. So it's not necessarily for people who are developing an addiction or starting to experiment with drugs, because it's difficult to reach those people. That's not the people you're going to be able to really reach. They're not going to be interested in what you have to offer. But there are a lot of people who are very interested in what you have to offer, including people who want to quit smoking.
Yeah.
And, so.
Just before we finish, I mean, one of the big issues nowadays, Colorado, maybe up in the Northwest also, and certainly in California, there's shops selling marijuana.
Yes.
Oh, special marijuanas, morning marijuana. It's like the Indian raga music, the morning marijuana, the evening marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sort of feeling about that as someone that looks at addiction and sees both sides of it, presumably?
My personal feeling
yes.
is that it's not a good idea to legalize marijuana. But I think that it's probably going to happen and sweep across the country.
And the reason? Because this is now to do with your profession as much as just an opinion. Why do you think it's not a good idea?
Because I think it will impact people's everyday lives, their ability to function properly. I think that it will make it easier for them to obtain marijuana and to use it excessively, and it's excessive use that's the problem.
So you use the word to behave normally. That's just a loaded expression,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. It's by normally, I really mean being able to function in everyday life and get done what you need to get done.
Professor Tamara Phillips, Professor of Behavioral Neuroscience from the Oregon Health and Science University, thank you so much for being here. It's been absolutely a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And Norma Martinez, want to thank you, as usual, for putting it together. And thank you to the listeners out there, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center El Paso and El Paso Children's Hospital are organizing the first ever El Paso Pediatric Colloquium. It takes place June 7th. The agenda includes a review of ethical dilemmas, clinical conundrums, and the use of simulation to address emergencies in the clinic setting. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from the Kindred Hospital.